Year's War by David Irving. Trouble from Providence. The Hitler of 1944 was unlike the confident Führer who had set out for the Polish front in his train in September 1939. His energy and willpower remained unsapped, but his secretaries noticed that sometimes his knees would begin to shake, or he had to clasp his trembling left hand with his right. Yet he refused to take these symptoms seriously. We know from Morel's papers that for 5 months after September 1943, he continually urged Hitler to submit a further electrocardiogram without success. When the adjutants reproved Morel for his treatment, his exasperated reply was invariably the same, quote, "You try treating a patient like the Führer," end quote. For all his obesity, Morel retained Hitler's affections. Each evening at Hitler's midnight tea party, Morel would be snoring loudly within minutes of slumping into an armchair. Hitler's eyes were alive with sympathy and indulgence at this spectacle. Quote, "He was and is the only one who can help me," he said. Sometimes Colonel von Bello, the Luftwaffe adjutant, gently nudged the doctor. Then the physician would wake up and chuckle loudly, assuming that the Führer had told a joke. Hitler rarely came in contact with people from the world outside his headquarters. Schmunt and Schaub introduced what new faces they could to the evening conversation parties. The architect Hermann Giesler, the wives of the adjutants and former members of Hitler's staff like Hans Pfeiffer and Hans Junge, both of whom would die in action shortly. Many of the old familiar faces were gone. Reichsleiter Bormann, Morel lamented in one letter, quote, "is mostly away on business in Berlin and Munich. Heine Hoffmann, the photographer, only puts in a guest's appearance every 4 weeks or so. Scarcely anybody of the old clique is still here. The headquarters has outgrown itself, and most people are preoccupied with themselves," end quote. Bormann's influence over Hitler was now immense. Rosenberg, Lammers, and other cabinet ministers rarely penetrated his protective shield around the Führer. Hitler was told only what Bormann and Himmler wanted him to know about internal Reich affairs. The long-delayed visit by Dr. Hans Frank, Governor-General of Occupied Poland, on February 16, 1944, provides a further significant example. The Russian army was now fighting on Polish soil, but Hitler, quote, "exceptionally forthright and looking the picture of a healthy, dynamic, and active man," as Frank wrote that day, assured the governor-general that he would not allow the general government to become a battlefield. Quote, "Yes, my dear Frank, it is odd. Previously, we regarded the general government as something of a backwater. Today, it is our bulwark against the East," unquote. He applauded Frank's new policies aimed at securing Polish assistance in the fight. But even Hans Frank seems to have been pulling the wool over his Führer's eyes. In his 18-page diary record of the discussion, Frank touched on the Jewish problem only once. Quote, "I said that eliminating the Jews by getting them out of the general government had taken a great load off the country's general situation," end quote. Afterward, Frank ran into Morel. Quote, "I asked him," wrote Frank, "about the Führer's health. He claimed it is better than ever before. His stomach pains are gone and his appetite has returned, a particularly good sign. He said he was proud of this achievement," end quote. Shortly after, Hitler's appetite failed again, however, though for a different reason. When Frau von Exner, the Viennese dietitian, became engaged to an SS adjutant at headquarters, it was learned that she had a Jewish great-grandmother. Hitler had to dismiss her. He told her, quote, "I cannot make one rule for myself and another for the rest," end quote. Thus, she would survive the war, more fortunate than her successor. Hitler's real fear was of the invasion threat looming in the West. Quote, "If only they would land 500,000 men," he reflected on December 30th, "and then foul weather and storms cut them off in the rear. Then everything would be all right," end quote. That day, Hitler had instructed his representatives in Copenhagen to resort to terrorist tactics to stamp out acts of sabotage and assassination by the underground in Denmark. He ordered Himmler's agents to strike back under cover against leading Danish opponents and their property. The next day, an SS marksman gunned down an opposition journalist. And a few days later, the spiritual leader of the Danish resistance, Pastor Kaj Munk, was assassinated. Quote, "You can't smash terrorism by philosophizing," end quote, Hitler told his generals on January 27, 1944. Quote, "You have to smash it by using even greater terror," end quote. The Duterte way. By early 1944, Rommel was confidently asserting his authority in preparing the anti-invasion defenses. Hitler was cautiously optimistic. The Allies, he reasoned, had secured footholds in Africa and Italy only because of the Italian traitors. Quote, they won't find any of those here. They'll get the thrashing of their lives, end quote. He also said, quote, "I am convinced that when the time comes, it will be a huge relief," end quote. He commanded that pillboxes for 3,000 new anti-tank and other guns were to be built by the end of April, at the very latest. Most important of all, he now gave Rommel's army group tactical command of the armies along the Channel coast. Hitler counted on the Desert Fox to light a bonfire under these armies before the Allies could in the spring. On January 15th, General Jodl reported to Hitler on his own tour of the Atlantic defenses. He was unimpressed by the pace of fortification activity. The Germans were fraternizing with the French coastal population, he said, and the Luftwaffe had not planned ahead at all. He supported Rommel's contentions wholeheartedly. Rommel began implementing tactical concepts strongly opposed to those of Rundstedt. The latter had planned a flexible defense on French soil with a powerful mobile reserve of panzer divisions in the rear. Rommel convincingly argued that the enemy, once ashore, could marshal such overwhelming material strength that he could never be dislodged. The panzer divisions must be brought right up to the coast. Otherwise, they would arrive too late or not at all, if the enemy destroyed the road and railway links before them. This tallied well with Hitler's vision. Quote, "The main thing," he said, "is that the moment the invasion begins, the enemy must be smothered in bombs. That'll force them to take cover, and if there's only one jet airborne, they'll still be forced to take cover, and this will delay them hour upon hour. But in half a day, our reserves will be well on their way." End quote. This delay would also enable Hitler to take stock, quote, "Which is the decoy and which is the real invasion?" End quote. With his party backing and his profound influence on Hitler, Rommel was able to start fresh divisions moving to the west. He demanded millions of mines per month. He prepared to flood low-lying areas. He drew up plans for submerged barriers of massive spikes to gash open the hulls of landing boats and nutcracker mines supported on iron girders, some visible, some below the water's surface. Tempted by the cash rewards, the male French population assisted, while their womenfolk made rush matting for sand traps or helped to erect anti-paratroop defenses. According to Rommel, they worked with a will and finished each day, quote, singing lustily, unquote. They knew what would happen to their towns and villages if France was turned into a battlefield. Wholly unexpectedly, and without even a hint from the German intelligence services, on January 22nd, an American corps staged a sudden seaborne landing south of Rome at Anzio, to the rear of the German lines. Misled by the assurances of Admiral Canaris, Kesselring had denuded this coastline. Only two German battalions met the American troops. Both sides fumbled. Kesselring delayed his counterattack for a week to allow heavy units to arrive. The Luftwaffe's Richthofen scornfully noted in his diary, quote, "Thus we violate the cardinal rule of war accepted for many millennia, to wade into enemy beachheads with everything you've got immediately so as to exploit the disorder always reigning in the first few days," end quote. But the Americans were even more hesitant in consolidating their beachhead. Quote, "Politics play a big part," Hill reminded Hitler. "No general over there can afford big defeats," end quote. Hitler reasoned, quote, "If we can wipe them out down there, then there won't be an invasion anywhere else," end quote. Roosevelt could not take such a risk in a presidential election year, but Hitler's sixth sense urged caution on him too, telling him that Anzio was less a battle for Rome than a sly enemy attempt to lure the high-grade German reserves away from France into a peripheral war of attrition in Italy. and after the long-delayed counterattack by Mackensen's 14th Army failed to throw the Americans back into the sea, he was content to see the beachhead merely contained. Hitler asked Jodl to determine precisely why intelligence had failed to predict the landing at Anzio. Kesselring claimed that it was Canaris' fault. Early in February, the defection to the British of Erich Vermehren, an important Abwehr agent in Turkey, put the last nail in the admiral's long-prepared coffin. This brought even Cicero's operations to an abrupt end. Hitler had had enough of Admiral Canaris. He told Himmler to set up a, quote, unified German secret intelligence service, unquote. On the Russian front, Hitler clung fanatically to his belief that Stalin's military strength was waning. Later, in February, Zeitzler's staff produced estimates that over 18 million of the 46 million able-bodied men available to Stalin in 1941 had now been eliminated by battle casualties or loss of territory. This was why Hitler defended every centimeter of ground, even though the Russians were still moving men and equipment into their battlefront faster than he himself could. As that front moved ever closer to German soil, Hitler's willingness to permit operational retreats like the Buffalo Movement of 1943 diminished. From now on, the German soldier would fight where he stood, holding out until the inevitable breach between East and West came to his salvation. Such was Hitler's strategy. In the north, Model's army group was preparing its final withdrawal to the East Wall line. In the center, Busch's line was still intact, but a gap of over 150 miles yawned north of Manstein's army group south. Since January, 284,000 German troops had been encircled at Cherkasy on the Dnieper River. After weeks of harrowing fighting, Hitler reluctantly authorized the garrison there to break out as best they could, leaving their injured to the mercies of the enemy. The dramatic escape began on the night of February 15th, led by a silent phalanx of troops with fixed bayonets, followed by the artillery and heavier equipment. Instead of the 2nd Panzer Corps waiting to receive them in a designated position, they were greeted by well-armed Russian units. Abandoning their heavy gear, the men fought on westward. They were confronted by a river spraying into the icy waters and forded it or were drowned. Only 30,000 of the 54,000 who set out reached the German lines. In the Cherkasy pocket, Stalin had again employed his deadly psychological weapon, the League of German Officers. Seydlitz and his fellow generals had broadcast appeals over Moscow radio to their encircled former comrades to lay down their arms. Officers in German uniform had infiltrated into the pocket to commit acts of sabotage and deliver secret letters from Seydlitz to the corps commanders, Stemmermann and Lieb. There was a curious sequel. At Goebbels' suggestion, indeed, at his dictation, General Schmundt drew up a declaration of personal loyalty to the Führer and took it on himself to secure every field marshal's signature to it. Flying first to the most senior of Germany's serving soldiers, von Rundstedt in France, and satisfying the field marshal of the authenticity of Seydlitz's treachery, Schmundt then went on to Model, Rommel, Kleist, Busch, Manstein, and Weichs in turn. The latter wrote in his diary, quote, "Such a reaffirmation of our oath of allegiance seems unmilitary to me. An officer's loyalty ought to be taken for granted," unquote. For a variety of reasons, Hitler decided it was time to go to the Obersalzberg for a while. He wanted to be closer to the Italian front. Quote, "We have built headquarters in just about every other corner of the Reich," he wanly joked. But never dreamed that we should one day need one near Italy," end quote. The truth was, however, that he could no longer take the risk of an enemy air raid on the Wolf's Lair in its present state. The British bomber force had a month earlier dropped 2,400 tons of bombs on Berlin in one night. Both the British and American air forces had East Prussia well within their range. Thus, he entrained for Munich on February 23, 1944. While the Tott organization moved in to erect even stronger bunkers at Rostenburg. It is unlikely that he glimpsed the bomb-torn ruins of the cities he passed through. He consistently and consciously avoided seeing the misery his enemies had wrought, and the blinds were drawn to shield his painful retinas. For 2 weeks now, he had been troubled by a stabbing pain and increasingly opaque veil in his right eye, of such turbidity as to render him virtually blind when he closed his other eye. That night, a heavy British attack was beginning on Schweinfurt, and 600 bombers were over Bavaria. The crack of the anti-aircraft batteries was still echoing around the sleepy valleys when Hitler arrived at the Berghof at 10:15 p.m. A staff stenographer wrote in his diary, quote, "The war conference was slated to begin at 11:30 p.m. As we stood by in the anteroom, the Führer came in with Reichsleiter Martin Bormann, Gruppenführer Albert Bormann, and the rest of his staff, having toured the air raid shelter tunnels built here in recent months. He welcomed us with a friendly grin. The conference began at 11:45 p.m. and ended at 5 past midnight." End quote. Camouflage netting covered the Berghof, and even at midday, only a melancholy twilight filtered through the famous windows of the Great Hall. This was just as well. On March 2nd, a leading Berlin eye specialist examined Hitler's blue-gray eyes. He diagnosed, quote, "minute hemorrhages in the vitreous humor," end quote, and recommended to Morell that the Führer submit to 2 quarter-hour periods of complete relaxation every day, with heat treatment by sun lamp, if possible. He was to avoid all, quote, "unnecessary excitement, particularly during the period immediately before the night's rest," end quote. Everybody who saw Hitler was shocked by his physical transformation. Defeat was carving deep hollows in his features. Small wonder that when Eva Braun gently reproached him for walking with a stoop, he would reply, quote, "that's because of the burden of worries I'm carrying all the time," end quote. Goebbels visited him on March 3rd, found one eye hideously bloodshot. The dictator revealed that he was now planning to invade Hungary when he would put paid to that country's treacherous aristocracy and its Jews once and for all. Hitler told the minister that as soon as he had dealt with the coming Allied invasion, if it invasion ever came, he would take 40 divisions from the west and hurl them at the eastern front. Bolstering Dr. Goebbels' own morale, he told him of the new Panther and Tiger tanks and the bigger and better firepower of their fighter planes. He urged the minister, however, to give his backing to Reichsmarshal Goering, failure though he was. Quote, "he can't stand criticism right now," he explained lamely. "You've got to watch your tongue very carefully when you tell him things," end quote. On March 5th, the two armaments, quote-unquote, dictators, Milch and Saar, came to the Berghof. Their report on future aircraft, tank, and gun production was optimistic despite the crushing blows dealt by the enemy bombers. Hitler agreed to make fighter aircraft production a top priority and demanded that the two planned bunker factories should each have at least 7 million square feet of floor space, capable of housing everything needed for aircraft manufacture, from the forging of the crankshafts and smelting of the steel down to the finished product. He released 64 miners to Saar from the gang's tunneling air raid shelters under the Berghof and advised him to train at least 10,000 more. He must not rest until Germany's entire war industry was underground. Wild. Flying bomb production was already there, underground. Milch gleefully urged Hitler to begin the attack on England on April 20th, Hitler's birthday, loosing off 1,500 of the pilotless missiles in the next 10 days and the rest in May. Quote, "it will be the most evil torture you can imagine," he told his staff. "Just picture yourselves, a large, high-explosive bomb falling on Berlin every half hour, and nobody knowing where the next will fall. 20 days of that will have them all folding at the knees," end quote. Hitler, however, delayed the flying bomb attack. Perhaps he wanted all the, quote-unquote, revenge weapons to fire simultaneously. A4 rocket flying bomb, quote-unquote, high-pressure pump, and Krupp's Gustav, long-range guns, coupled with a saturation attack on London by Sproul's 3rd Air Force. But the Army's rocket missile was well behind schedule. In January, only 50. In February, only 86 A4s had left the underground, Central Works. In May, Pinamonte's General Dornberger wryly reported, quote, "our main problem is getting the missiles to the target in one piece," end quote. Most of them were blowing up in midair. Speer's closest advisor, Karl Otto Saur, recommended on March 5th that Hitler consider converting the Central Works factory from A4 assembly to fighter aircraft manufacture. The tunnels were big enough to house a plant turning out 1,000 planes a month. Hitler appeared to agree, but someone changed his mind again. Perhaps it was Speer himself, whom Hitler visited 2 weeks later bearing a bouquet of flowers on the minister's 39th birthday. Mistrustfully, Hitler had taken to summoning low-ranking officers to the Berghof and hearing them closely out. For several days, he interviewed soldiers from platoon level upward about the fighting at Anzio. They told him of the crushing enemy artillery superiority, of inferior German radio gear, and of faulty hand grenades. He then invited the generals, a Panzer General Gerd von Schwerin, related how the Russians had kept their notorious wet-weather offensive rolling by rounding up thousands of women and making each one wade 10 miles through the slime to the front lines with a shell on her back. The new force in Hitler's life was undeniably Grand Admiral Karl Dönitz. It was the admiral who had cajoled Hitler into preventing the earlier withdrawal of Army Group North to the East Wall. It was Dönitz, too, who had demanded the retention of the Crimea. And now that Hitler's health was poor, it was Dönitz and not Goering whom he sent to preside over the Memorial Day parade in Berlin and to address the 10,000 new officer candidates in Breslau. Goering and Ribbentrop were deeply wounded by Hitler's loss of faith in them. The latter privately made an offer to Hitler, which showed that he certainly made up in personal courage whatever he might lack in diplomacy. As Walter Schellenberg, chief of Himmler's Foreign Intelligence Service, later wrote, quote, Ribbentrop told the Führer frankly that their biggest and most dangerous enemy was the Soviet Union. The Führer shared this view and even mused out loud that Stalin was the only one for whom he could find the necessary respect if one day he was going to reach a compromise peace with somebody after all. He, Ribbentrop, then announced to the Führer his willingness to sacrifice his own life if he could to save Germany thereby. His plan was to do all he could to lure Stalin once more to the conference table. Then he would gun him down. For a long time, the Führer had turned this over in his mind, and then finally replied, quote, No, I don't like anything like that. It would be asking for trouble from Providence, end quote. One day in mid-March 1944, Hitler invited Goebbels to stay at the snow-covered Berghof. Together they watched several of the color movies that Eva Braun had shot of them in 1939, and again in 1942. Goebbels now noticed even more forcefully how aged and stooped the Führer had become in those 3 years. Hitler remarked that he was longing for the Allied invasion to come so he could get it over with. He had reacted to Italy's defection in September 1943. He said, by ordering contingency plans for the armed occupation of Romania and Hungary, codenamed Margareth I and II, should either Antonescu or Horthy follow Badoglio's example. Antonescu had sworn continued loyalty, and Hitler believed him. Horthy, however, was something else. Hungary had not only refused formal recognition of the new Mussolini government, but had accepted legations from both the Badoglio and the fascist regimes, and she had noisily demanded the return of her 9 light divisions policing the rear areas on the Russian front. In February 1944, Ribbentrop received a report proving that Hungary was clandestinely dealing with the enemy, and in mid-March, Himmler learned that Prime Minister Calais was advocating the sabotage of German trains running through Hungary to Manstein's and Kleist's army groups. Hitler decided that the time had come to occupy Hungary. In its original form, Margareth had projected using Slovak, Croat, and Romanian soldiers as well as Germans for the invasion of Hungary. On March 8th, Hitler selected Sunday the 19th as the invasion date, but he decided to use only German troops. Use of the hated satellites would destroy Hungary's economic stability. The OKW order for Margareth was issued on the 11th. If the Hungarians did resist the German invasion, this said their army was to be disarmed and ringleaders shot. On March 15th, Horthy was invited to present himself at Klesheim Castle, near Salzburg, in 3 days' time. Since Hitler offered the invitation to deal with the military points raised in Horthy's letter of February 12th, which he explained he had been unable to answer earlier because of illness, Horthy would probably bring his military chiefs with him. Thus, Hungary would be leaderless if Margarethe did result in a pitched battle. Horthy agreed to come with his generals on the 18th. On the day before, Hitler plotted with Ribbentrop, Jodl, and Himmler the precise scenario for the confrontation. At 12:30, there would probably be a break for lunch. This would enable Hitler to decide whether or not the Hungarians would have to be disarmed. Quote, if Horthy permits the invasion and there is no resistance, then we defer decision on disarming and demobilizing them, end quote, wrote Jodl in his diary. Every word spoken would be monitored by hidden microphones and recorded on discs in the castle's control room. This time, Hitler would accept no, quote-unquote, lame excuses from the slippery admiral. Quote, he's a cunning rogue, end quote, he had told General Zietzler after the April 1943 meeting with Horthy. Quote, yesterday I got him to agree with everything I wanted in private, and today he comes back and says, you know, I'm very hard of hearing. It seems I only understood half of what you were saying yesterday, end quote. Hitler evidently anticipated worse than the mere duplicity with the Hungarians this time. As he sat next to his chauffeur in his open Mercedes for the drive down to Klesheim, he opened the glove compartment, took out a revolver, and checked that it was loaded. He clutched it on his lap for a while, then put it away, turning to Sonnleitner as he did so. Quote, will the admiral have eaten? He asked. The diplomat nodded. Sure enough, as Hitler had expected, the admiral objected to the presence of Hitler's regular interpreter and insisted on talking with him in German and, as he thought, in privacy. Hitler did not mince his language. He insisted that Horthy replace Calais as prime minister. He announced that he had decided to march 12 German divisions into Hungary immediately to, quote-unquote, assist the new government, and he demanded that Hungary's numerous divisions presently mobilized against the Romanian frontier be sent to the Russian front instead. Believing perhaps that Hitler was bluffing, Horthy charged out of the room, exclaiming, quote, if it's all been decided already, there's no point in my staying, end quote. At a given signal from Hitler, the air raid siren sounded and a smokescreen was laid across the castle. Horthy was told that his train could not leave in the middle of an air raid. After lunch, with Himmler and the generals, Hitler inquired loudly of Keitel whether the invasion could be postponed. Keitel replied that the troops were already on the move and could not be recalled. It was now clear to Horthy that he had been ambushed. Toward 8 p.m., he cabled instructions to his cabinet in Budapest to permit the invasion. Hitler's only concession had been to agree not to occupy Budapest itself, apart from a quote-unquote guard of honor for Horthy. Now, wreathed in smiles, the Führer conducted the aged regent to his train at 9 o'clock. It was the last time he was to see him. On Austrian soil, the train was halted for several hours. It appears that Horthy's safe return was dependent on his cabinet's honoring the agreement. Four German battle groups invaded Hungary concentrically at 4 a.m. at the Citadel, Horthy's official residence. A German guard of honor, immaculate and ominous, was awaiting him when he arrived at 11. This, Hitler's last conquest, was truly an outstanding coup. The invading divisions had been subtracted from the Anzio battlefield and virtually every other front, but Hungary's industrial potential was well worth the price. That very night of March 18th, Hitler sent for Saar and instructed him to harness Hungarian industry to the war effort at once. The lower echelons of the Hungarian forces actually welcomed the invasion. Eventually, the Hungarian contingent on the Russian front was doubled. Marshal Antonescu could also increase the Romanian contingent, now that he no longer needed fear war with Hungary. Even so, Field Marshal von Weichs, Commander-in-Chief Southeast, whose headquarters now transferred to Budapest, wrote after seeing Hitler on March 28th, quote, the Führer mistrusts the Hungarians and particularly hates the regent, who no doubt equally loathes Germany. The links with the enemy powers still exist. Her defection is still to be reckoned with, a colossal danger for the Eastern Front. Thus, as few Hungarians as possible are to be under arms, though it will be impossible to disarm the army completely. On March 19th, as end quote, by the way, on March 19th, 1944, the day after invading Hungary, Hitler conferred at the Berghof with his leading field marshals. Rundstedt stepped forward and read to an impassive Führer the declaration of personal loyalty which all the field marshals had now signed. Thus the German army cast out Seydlitz and his ilk from its ranks. The next day, March 20th, 1944, Hitler delivered to all the leading generals of the Western Front a historic speech with, according to Rommel's diary, quote, marvelous clarity and sovereign composure, unquote. After mentioning the new jet fighters and submarine types, he warned the generals to be on guard against enemy airborne operations in the rear. He again expressed the conviction that the Allies would invade Normandy and Brittany, and not the much closer Channel coastline. There is a shorthand record of Hitler's speech among Rommel's papers. Quote, obviously, he said, an Anglo-American invasion in the West is going to come. Just how and where, nobody knows, and it isn't practicable to speculate. You can't take shipping concentrations at face value for some kind of clue that their choice has fallen on any particular sector of our long western front from Norway down to the Bay of Biscay or the Mediterranean or Balkans. Such concentrations can always be moved around or transferred at any time, under cover of bad visibility, and they will obviously be used to dupe us. The most suitable landing areas, and hence those that are in most danger, are the two west coast peninsulas of Cherbourg and Brest. They offer very tempting possibilities for the creation of bridgeheads, which could thereafter be systematically enlarged by the massive use of air power. In simple terms, Hitler explained to these Western Front commanders what would be at stake. The enemy's entire invasion operation must not, under any circumstances, be allowed to survive longer than hours, or at most days. Taking Dieppe as an example, as an ideal example. Once defeated, the enemy will never again try to invade. Quite apart from their heavy losses, they will need months to organize a fresh attempt, and an invasion failure will also deliver a crushing blow to British and American morale. For one thing, it will prevent Roosevelt from being re-elected in the United States. With any luck, he'll finish up in jail somewhere. For another, war weariness will grip Britain even faster, and Churchill, already a sick old man with his influence waning, won't be able to carry through a new invasion operation. End quote. In conclusion, Hitler explained why the defeat of Overlord would lead to a final victory for Germany. Quote, the 45 divisions that we now hold throughout Europe, apart from the Eastern Front, are badly needed in the East. As soon as we have forced the decision in the West, we shall transfer them to the East to revolutionize the situation there. So the whole outcome of the war depends on each man fighting in the West, and that means the fate of the Reich as well. End quote. Afterward, Hitler conferred alone with Rommel and awarded him control of the 1st and 19th Armies, as well as greater influence over the motorized divisions, which were Rundstedt's only tactical reserve. Rundstedt grumpily saw little point in remaining as Commander-in-Chief West, but stayed nonetheless. Now it was Rommel who was the optimist. Quote, we have the utmost confidence that we'll get by in the West, he wrote privately. And unquote. The Allied bombing of German cities continued. When the Russians tried and executed as war criminals certain German officers, Hitler yearned to follow suit. On March 23rd, he told Huell, quote, British and American war criminals must also be condemned to death, and their confessions must also be publicized after their execution, end quote. Allied airmen accused of machine-gunning civilians were to be put on trial. General Jodl suggested that since the enemy automatically executed all German agents, they should do the same with 500 British and American agents and saboteurs who had fallen into their net in Hungary. Quote, the Führer mentioned, noted Huell, that some had special assignments to murder and spread bacilli epidemics. End quote. On the night of March 24th, the British again dumped nearly 2,500 tons of high explosives and incendiary bombs on Berlin. No Geneva Convention forbade these murderous bombing raids. When the next morning Himmler announced at the Berghof that 80 Allied airmen had just escaped from a Wehrmacht prison camp at Sagan, Hitler impulsively ordered all these escapees recaptured to be turned over to the secret police. Quote, Himmler, you are not to let the escaped airmen out of your control, end quote. 50 of the fugitives were shot on Himmler's orders. This climate of barbarism was now pervading the war. During May 1944, Allied planes began systematically machine-gunning civilian targets. Several films taken from the gun cameras of crashed fighter planes were shown at the Berghof. They showed helpless people running for their lives as the bullets streamed toward them. Hitler instructed Goering to select isolated cases and execute the culprits. Goering was reluctant, explaining to Sonnleitner that pilots could not be blamed for having, quote-unquote, hunting fever. Jodl's staff suggested giving oral instructions to the commandant of the prison cage at Oberursel to turn over such airmen to Himmler's security police. But the technical problems, particularly of identification, proved insuperable. Everybody raised objections. Keitel was opposed to such regularized, quote, lynch law, unquote. And Goering pointed out that clear cases of murder could be dealt with by properly constituted courts. The foreign ministry then stated that the Geneva Convention required a 3-month stay of execution of death sentences on prisoners of war. By this time, it was late June 1944, and Hitler had more pressing problems on his mind. By late March 1944, a new irreconcilable difference had emerged between Hitler and Manstein. At his noon conference at the Berghof on March 25th, the Field Marshal fought for permission to withdraw General Huber's encircled 1st Panzer Army to the northwest before a second Stalingrad resulted. Hitler, however, insisted that Huber retain his existing battlefront between the Dniester and Tarnopol, a town he now declared a quote-unquote fortified area. He had just introduced this new fortress-like concept for key coastal towns in the west. They were to be commanded by hand-picked army generals who would not lose their nerve when the enemy tide swept past their strongholds. He blamed Manstein for the present dilemma of the 1st Panzer Army. Manstein had tolerated one withdrawal after another, although Goering had reported that his troops were being put to flight by only a handful of Soviet tanks. Field Marshal von Kleist followed Manstein to the Berghof on March 27th to plead for the withdrawal of his Army Group A. Shortly after he had left, Hitler told General Zietzler, quote, I have decided to release Manstein and Kleist, end quote. Zietzler recognized that arguing was no use. The Führer sent his plane to fetch the two field marshals back to the Berghof on March 30th. Probably both Goering and Himmler lay behind Manstein's dismissal. The famous interruption during Hitler's January speech to the generals was a further cause. He told Manstein that evening, before the main conference, that what the Southern Front needed was a new name, a new slogan, and a commander expert in defensive strategy. He meant Model. There was no bitterness between them. Hitler told an adjutant long afterward that should he ever come to mount great offensives again, Marshal Manstein would be their first commander. Manstein had, after all, been the only general to speak out for the Sedan breakthrough strategy in 1940, and that was something he would not easily forget. Model was already waiting outside with Kleist's successor, General Ferdinand Schirner. Hitler offered Manstein his hand. The field marshal took it and said, quote, I hope for your sake that your decision today turns out right for you. End quote. And that's the end of the chapter.